Good evening and a wonderful Erev Shabbat to everyone. It's been several months since the last podcast, and I'm hoping very soon to be able to resume the weekly podcasts and to finish the series on Megillat Esther that we began last winter. But in the meantime, just a relatively brief observation about the Parsha, Parshat Vayetze, something which generally eludes our attention. And it is something of a subtext in the entire story of Parshat Vayetze, and I need a couple introductory comments about the Parsha itself. But then when we take a look further, we see that it is a theme that runs through several stories in Sefer Bereshit, and even later on in Tanakh, and may have implications for several different avenues of our understanding of the text, including some which have been somewhat highlighted as controversial in the last number of years. So the first thing is of Parshat Vayetze itself. As we all know, when we take a look into a Sefer Torah, into a scroll of the Torah, we see that there are words. We're able to discern words from each other because there is a larger space than the normal space between letters that separates words. But that's really the only division that we have built into the text. As to how to punctuate the text, where a verse ends, these are all based on tradition, what we call Mesorah, that allows us to parse the reading properly. However, there are none of those divisions written into the text. The only division that's really hardwired into the text is a division into paragraphs. It would be accurate to say that the Torah is not written in sentences. It is rather written in paragraphs. These paragraphs are called parashot. And without going into too much detail, there are different types of paragraphs. There is a parsha ptucha, which begins on a new line. There is a parsha stuma, which begins 9 blank spaces after the end of the previous paragraph on the same line. And even the Rishonim discuss a third kind of parsha, which is called a parsha sedura, in which it begins on the next line directly underneath the end of the previous line, one that we do not practice today. But these divisions are inherent in the text, inherent in the graphic representation of the text. The reason I'm bringing this up is because when you look through the book of Bereshit, you see that in some instances, every sub-story and every sub-component has its own parasha. Case in point is the beginning of the Torah. The first 5 verses, the quote-unquote first day of creation, as it describes itself, is one separate parasha. The second day, etc., etc., each one of the days is a separate parasha. When you get to the second story of creation, the beginning of the second chapter, suddenly the entire story, all the way through the story of the garden, or at least till near the end of the story in the garden, is all one story, is all one parasha. Not to indicate that there aren't sub-stories within it, but it's presented as one paragraph in the text. And indeed, as you look through the patriarchal narratives, you see that, for instance, in Parshat Chaye Sarah, which we read 2 weeks ago, we see that there are 3 parashot. The first one is the story of the purchase of the cave at Machpelah. The second one is the very long, detailed story of finding a wife for Yitzchak. And then, excuse me, there are really 4. Then there is the latter marriage of Avraham, followed by his death. And then there is a record of the descendants of Yishmael. When you look into Toladot, which we read last week, you find again 4 parashot. The first one, the birth of Yaakov and Esav, and the negotiations for the right of the firstborn. Then there is the long detailed story of Yitzchak's visit to Gerar, followed by a very short parasha about Esav's marriage, and a very long parasha, which takes us to the very end of Toladot, which is the story of the deception and the theft of the bracha, and Yaakov's need to run away. This all becomes far more interesting when we take a look at Parashat Vayetze. Because in Parashat Vayetze, which we are reading this week, We note that although the parashah takes place over a wide geographic plain, going from Be'er Sheva, stopping in Beit El, all the way to South Turkey and Haran, and all the way back to Transjordan, where Machanaim, and mentioned in the very last word of the parashah, is located. Nonetheless, the entire story involving Yaakov on his own, Yaakov meeting Lavan, Yaakov marrying Leah and then Rachel, Yaakov having 12 children, Yaakov becoming very wealthy, Yaakov running away, Yaakov and Lavan contesting each other's claims, all of this is one paragraph. Begin Vayetse, and you are not done with the paragraph until you get to the word Machanayim at the very end of the parasha. This is interesting in and of itself, but it may help us gain a fresh look at the entire story in Vayetse when we see some interesting things taking place. For instance, the very beginning of the parasha starts out with Yaakov having a vision in which he sees angels, and subsequently, when after the vision, he renames the location Beit El based on that vision. At the very end of the parasha, Yaakov, leaving Haran, sees angels and renames the place Machanayim as a result of his vision. You go further in and you find that Yaakov is involved with moving rocks around. He sets up a matzeva. He comes to Haran, and he encounters the shepherds who are trying to move the rock, and he helps them move the rock off the top of the well. At the very end of the parasha, you find that Yaakov is interacting with shepherds, with Achim, same word that he used earlier, and it's a word we're going to get back to in the core part of this podcast, and it involves rocks. They help him set up a rock of testimony, the Gal Ed on Har Gilad, to clarify the line of division between Yaakov and Lavan, and so forth and so on. As you move closer into towards the middle of the parasha, you find that there are mirror images meeting each other, which ultimately seem to find their middle point at the point in chapter 30, verse 25, when Yosef is born, and Yaakov's reaction to the birth of Yosef is to say to Lavan, "It's time for me to go back." Why that's the case is a longer piece and one that's not directly germane to the podcast today, but nonetheless, just something interesting to observe about the parasha. The reason I bring that up is because I want to look at a relationship or a set of relationships that develops and changes over the course of this parasha, and for reasons that I'll talk about for a couple of moments, we may not read it accurately in the text because we come to the text with a prefigured notion of how we should be reading those relationships and don't necessarily see them clearly. The key player in this parasha is clearly Yaakov. However, his key opposite number in this parasha from beginning to end is Lavan. And Lavan, who was given a very harsh treatment in the Midrash, so much so that when we first meet him, for the very first time, when Avraham's slave comes to Haran, and Avraham's slave appears and is greeted warmly by Lavan, we immediately cast suspicion on his warmth and on his greeting, suspecting that he is embracing the slave in order to find out if he's hiding any jewels, etc. And we read Lavan with this very jaundiced eye and this very suspicious attitude from beginning to end. And this is, of course, in accord with the Midrashic treatment of Lavan, Lavan ha-Arami, who very clearly, if you transpose those letters, is Lavan ha-Romai, and becomes, therefore, the image of the Roman overlords under whom we are subservient during the Midrashic period. The question is, how should we read Lavan in the text itself? And for that, perhaps we would be best served by Rashi's advice based on the Midrash Halacha, Let's take a fresh look at what the text presents to us about Lavan, and not just about Lavan himself, but how others relate to Lavan, and that may give us a better sense of what's happening. And we get several clues, and not just clues, but several evidently clear statements throughout the story, both before we begin Parshat Vayetse, and throughout the story itself that indicate that Lavan is not nearly as horrendous as we paint him to be, at least from a simple read of the text. The first indication is as follows. When we first met Lavan, when Avraham's slave came, Lavan greeted him, brought him into the house, had him tell his story, and then Lavan's reaction was, if this is what God has decided, lo nuchal daber elacha ra otov, we have nothing to say about it. Then, perhaps, we could have some critique about the fact that he seems to go back on that and says, wait a second, let the girl stay here for a while, she doesn't need to leave right away, tesheva narana itanu yamim o asor achar telech. But on the other hand, that was never part of what they agreed to originally. They didn't agree that Rivka would leave right away. And now they're saying, well, you want to leave, but we're not ready for her to leave right away. And when she says, I will go with him, they acquiesce immediately, give her a nice bracha, and send her on her way. Very good. What becomes far more curious to us is the fact that Rivka, who is operating and who is determining how things for Yaakov will play out by first arranging the deception in which he is dressed and appears to be Esav and presents food as if he's Esav and gets the bracha, and then the result of that is that Esav is very angry at him, and Rivka tells Yaakov, she doesn't tell him to run away, she says, run to Lavan, my brother. And then she says to Yitzchak a very simple line. She says that, I can't stand the local girls, and if Yaakov marries one of the local girls, I have no reason to live. What is Yitzchak's reaction to that? Yitzchak's reaction is not, Yaakov, I want you to go somewhere else and find a girl. Rather, he says basically what his father said on his behalf. I want you to go back to Haran and find a girl. But he doesn't stop at that. He doesn't say, I want you to go to Haran and find some descendant of Nahor, of the family that's still in Haran. Rather, he says, I want you to go to the house of Lavan, Achi Imecha. I want you to go to your uncle's house, to Lavan, and marry one of his daughters. Now, why would Rivka, on one hand, be pushing Yaakov to go specifically to Lavan's house, and then why would Yitzchak be directing him not only to go to his house, but to marry one of his daughters, if Lavan is such a treacherous person? It'd be very hard for us to believe that somebody who is so treacherous and so deceptive and so conniving and so evil would have children who we would be interested in having marry in. After all, we're not marrying a local Kanani girl because the Kananim are supposedly terrible. If that's the case, why are we going all the way to Haran to marry somebody from such a terrible father? This itself is a question. But something else happens. We read the story of Yaakov arriving immediately with an eye of Yaakov being the underdog and the one who is manipulated and the one who is at a disadvantage against Lavan, who has all the cards and is in the power position, which of course is true. But we even read that along the way of seeing how Lavan interacts with Yaakov from the beginning of the parsha. But that becomes a little bit difficult for the following reason. When we look at chapter 31, which is when Yaakov finally separates and finally runs away, as it were, from Lavan, it isn't motivated by his saying, I know that Lavan is a bad guy and I've got to get away from him. But rather, he says as follows. Yaakov calls to Rachel and Leah, and in Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Hei, chapter 31, verse 5, it says, Vayomer lahen, ro'eh anochi at pnei avichen, ke inenu ilaik itmol shalshom. I see that your father is no longer looking at me like he used to. Tmol shalshom, which literally means yesterday and the day before, is a biblical idiom for the past. There's many examples of that. Joshua 3 in the first couple of verses. Many, many examples of that. Einenu ilaik itmol shalshom, which means Lavan is no longer looking at me the way that he used to be looking at him. And that is attested to in verse 2. Vayar Yaakov et pnei Lavan v'inenu imo kitmol shalshom. Inenu imo means he used to be with him. They used to be partners. They used to be a good feeling. Whatever it is, Yaakov now senses that the winds have changed. We will see why the winds have changed. But that's what Yaakov senses, and that's what causes him then to say, we have to leave, and that's what leads to Yaakov leaving the way that he does. All right. What is it that happened over the course of the years that would cause us to think that Lavan was indeed and all of those things we described earlier on? Well, the first famous incident, of course, is the switching of the wives. Yaakov works for Rachel for 7 years, turns around and says, Havayat ishti v'avoy leha, let me have my wife, I want to have relations with her. We could discuss also the propriety of such a such language, but and Lavan seems to agree, and as we know, gives him Leah, and the next morning he realizes it's Leah, and he comes with a complaint. Now let's look carefully at the words of the complaint. He says, "Vayomer Lavan lo yaasechem mimkomenu." Further, Yaakov says in chapter 29, verse 25, "Vahiva boker v'nehi Leah." In the morning, behold, it's Leah. "Vayomer el Lavan, mazot asitali. What did you do to me? Halo v'Rachel avadti imach v'lamari mitani. I worked for you for Rachel, and why did you trick me?" What is Lavan's response? "Vayomer Lavan lo yaasechem bimkomenu latetat siira lifnei bechira." It will not be done this way in our place. This is not how it's done, to have the younger girl marry before the older girl. Male shvua zot. Give this girl her week. V'ninalacha gam et zot, and we'll give you the other one. Ba'avodash tavori madiot shevashnim acherot. You can work another 7 years, but I'll give you Rachel, and then you can work for 7 years for her. And Yaakov doesn't respond. Yaakov does not have any sort of a counter to Lavan, where he says, oh, wait a second. If you're going to do that, then at least marry Rachel first, or I don't want to work another 7 years for you. I'm not interested in Leah. He doesn't come out with a response, and that is not because Yaakov is unable to respond when he has a response, and it is not because Yaakov does not know how to speak in the legal terminology of the place when he needs to, because the end of the parasha is a long legal dispute between Yaakov and Lavan with accusations and counter-accusations and proofs and evidence and testimony and treaty. It's all very legalistic. And Yaakov is perfectly capable of doing that. And yet here, after his one complaint, his one comment, Lavan responds, and that's the end of the story. And Yaakov doesn't say anything more. Why is that the case? So let's roll back a little bit. What do we know about Lavan's family? We know that Lavan, when Yaakov arrives, that Lavan has daughters. We know that these daughters are somewhat young. We know that they are young because Lavan is a wealthy man, a powerful man, as we can see, and he's got daughters who are not married. So that already tells us that they are relatively young. Does Lavan have sons? It seems that Lavan does not have sons. Why does Lavan not have sons? Why do I say that? Because who is shepherding Lavan's flock at the beginning when Lavan has a relatively small flock? Lavan himself says that since Yaakov came, things have gotten much better. Who is shepherding the flock? The answer is Rachel is. Why is Rachel shepherding the flock? Evidently there are no sons, or no sons are capable of shepherding a flock who are there in the family. So there's Rachel, Leah, and that seems to be the family. Now, how old is Rachel at the time? So we would have to posit that Rachel is a relatively young girl, and the reason for that is simply because of what we know about society in the times of Tanakh, and in the times of Chazal, and in the classical period, and really into the medieval period also. Throughout most of human history, girls got married roughly at the age of puberty for many reasons, both sociological and because of reproduction, and so a girl would pretty much be married by the time she was about 12 or 13. Now, if Yaakov comes to Lavan and says, I want to work for Rachel, and Lavan says that's a 7-year deal, that seems to indicate that Rachel is roughly 7 years before she is ready to be married. Because Lavan's not going to lock up his daughter and have her be sitting there waiting for somebody to marry him while she's spending these healthy childbearing years not married. That wouldn't make much sense within the context of society. So she's a relatively young girl. Now, how old is Leah? Leah is older than her. We don't know how much older. But we have every reason to believe that Leah is just a couple years older, which means Leah herself is also before marital age. which means that when Yaakov comes and says, I want to work for Rachel, it says, okay, what does Lavan say? Tov titi ota lachmi titi ota liish acher. It's better that she should marry you than marry somebody else. Not exactly a ringing endorsement, but all right, so she'll marry Yaakov. What is Lavan imagining in the meantime? That by the time that happens, Leah will already be married. Surprise, surprise, surprise. 7 years later, Leah's not married. She's already maybe an old maid of 15, but she's not married. And that sounds pretty humorous to us, but you have to realize, in the ancient world, 15, very likely in many societies, was an old maid if you weren't married. And so so suddenly we've got a situation where Yaakov is about to marry Rachel. And by the way, Yaakov does not say, give me Rachel. He says, give me my wife. What does Lavan do? Lavan simply gives him the wife that he should be marrying, which is the girl, because in our place, we would not allow a younger girl to marry before an older girl, and there is a subtle bit of mussar there that Lavan is saying. Lo yasachen bimekomenu. In our place, we don't have the younger go in front of the older. We respect the protocol, and we respect birth order. Unlike you, who deceives your brother, etc., etc., Chazal pick up on that, on the fact that there is some mussar in Lavan's words, some chastisement in Lavan's words to Yaakov. But in any case, Lavan then does what is based on local protocol. And again, you notice that not only Yaakov does not have a retort, but none of the other people who are assembled there for the wedding, and we should certainly assume an assemblage of sorts for this wedding, nobody says anything either. We don't find other people intervening in any way. And so Yaakov marries Leah, and a week later marries Rachel, and then we have everything play out. Lavan is out of the picture for a while, because the entire focus of the text, from the middle of chapter 29 to the middle of chapter 30, is on Yaakov and his children. Yaakov and his wives and children and the naming and the little events that happen in the middle, the Dudaim, etc. Lavan comes back into the picture at what point? And in chapter 30, verse 25, when Rachel gives birth to Yosef, and Yaakov comes to Lavan and says the following. It's a very interesting line. He says, Tna et nashai vet yeladai. Give me my wives and my children. Now, that's a very strange statement, but it makes it sound as if his wives and his children really don't belong to him yet. They belong to Lavan, and Yaakov is now making a claim, I've already finished my work, now I should get them. What is the premise for that? Well, it's interesting that if you look in the Torah, you'll find the premise right there. Look in Shmot Chaf Aleph, in the opening lines of Parshat Mishpatim, talks about an Eved Ivri. And what's the rule of an Eved Ivri? If he comes to his master married, then he leaves with his wife. If he comes to his master alone, and his master gives him a wife, and she bears him children, they belong to the master, and the slave leaves alone. Which means that we have some sort of a tussle going on here between the notion of Yaakov being an indentured servant, as it were, to Lavan, or being a contracted herdsman to Lavan, in which case the whole relationship with the family is going to be different. Yaakov's claim is, I finished my work for them, and I have now earned them, and so therefore I want them. All right? And Lavan does not protest against that. And Lavan says, after all, your presence has blessed my flock, and everything has gone very well. And Yaakov says, you know that I've worked for you very well. But so far, it's all very positive. There's no acrimony, and there's no contrariness that's going on. And now, what happens in chapter 30, verse 30? Lavan says, Yaakov says, you see that I've been very blessed, and now I have to create assets. Because let's take a look at this bottom line, a literal bottom line. Yaakov arrived in Haran 14 years earlier with nothing. But he arrived with nothing and also little responsibility. Now suddenly he's got four wives, 12 kids, and still no assets. He can't leave now to go back home. He's got no assets to take care of his family. So he says, Mataya esau nochi gam lebeti, meaning as follows. Had Yaakov come and his interest not been in marrying, let's say he was already married, didn't want to marry, and come to Lavan, and Lavan said to him, what's your salary? Yaakov would have said, I want 20% of the profits. Yaakov would have said, I want 15% of the newborn ewes, I want to keep them as assets. He would be able to say that. They'd write out a contract. We have records of such contracts from that period, from that location, from the area of Haran, from the middle of the second millennium BCE. And that's the way contracts are written. You'd get a certain amount, and there would be a certain amount of loss that would be acceptable of animals being killed and animals being stolen. And that's all within the contract. Instead, Yaakov said that I want to marry Rachel. So that ends up being not 7, but 14 years. So now he needs assets. So they end up making an agreement, which is as follows. Yaakov says, let's separate out all of these, and takes an arbitrary group of the spotted, striped, whatever it is, kind of sheep. Let's separate them out. I'll give them to my sons. In the meantime, I will continue shepherding your flock, and if any non-striped, as an example, a non-spotted sheep show up in my flock, that's called stolen. And that's a contractual agreement. And they separate. And what happens is, suddenly, the flock goes crazy having spotted, or whatever it is that Yaakov is going to be getting as per the deal, that's what is born. Now, whether it's because Yaakov understands genetics, whether Yaakov has some sort of a piece that's alluded to with the stick and the almond, the lach veluz, and these particular wood that he uses, and the water that he leads them to, or whether it's directly absolutely supernatural, nay, it's clearly Yad Hashem, clearly God's hand here is guiding, and the girls themselves say that. So what happens is suddenly Yaakov's wealth grows. By the way, at this point still, the sense of the text is that Lavan and Yaakov are working together, meaning that they're cooperating. And now, instead of having an arrangement where Yaakov is working for, as it were, the ketubah, in order to gain the wife, instead he's working now to create assets. That's all fine and dandy until a new character or set of characters shows up, which I think really are the key to everything changing here, but we miss them. And they show up at the very beginning of chapter 31, Pasuk Aleph. Suddenly, Vayishma divrei v'nei Lavan lemor. Suddenly Yaakov hears that Lavan's sons, who are Lavan's sons? Where did Lavan's sons come from? Yeah, but let's remember, there's been 20 years since Yaakov got here. There's 20 years since Yaakov met the young Rachel and ended up 7 years later, which means 13 years ago, marrying Leah and Rachel 1 week after the other, one and then another week later. There's been 13 years since then. So suddenly, there are B'nai Lavan. Now, what are B'nai Lavan? What is their complaint? Their complaint and their challenge that they feel from Yaakov is as follows. Lakach Yaakov et kol asher lavinu. Yaakov has taken everything that belongs to our father, which really what that means is he's taking our future inheritance. Me'asher lavinu asad kol hakavod hazeh. And it's from everything that belongs to our father, he's made up this great estate of his. And so what happens? Vayar Yaakov b'nei Lavan, v'yinom imokit, moshel shom. That brings us back to where we were. Yaakov looks at Lavan, and he sees that Lavan is no longer relating to him like he used to. In other words, it isn't so much Lavan, it's Lavan's sons that are suddenly itching about their own inheritance. Now, what existed beforehand? So here we have a scenario, as I mentioned, that does not start here. It's one that exists elsewhere in Bereishit, earlier in Bereishit, later in Bereishit, and later on in Tanakh. When Yaakov arrives, Yaakov is evidently the only male that's connected to the family. Again, there don't seem to be any sons. And Yaakov is taken in. And Yaakov is taken in by his uncle, who calls him Achi. Does that remind us of anybody? Of course it does. It reminds us of the relationship between Avraham and Lot, the exact relationship of a nephew, his sibling's son, who has come to him because of a reason he had to get away, in Lot's case because his father died. He is taken in, and they end up becoming business partners and working together. The same phrasing of Achi. Now, do we have another situation where a second-rate son, a quasi-son, comes into the picture first, there are no other sons around, and assumes a prominent role in the family, or potentially a prominent role in the family, and then when a quote-unquote real son, a Class A son, shows up, suddenly this outside son is disenfranchised. Of course we have examples of that. So let's first look at it in the context of Yaakov and see the politics that have been playing here and the shifts that have taken place, and then we will see it in other instances. If Yaakov first appears at a time when Laban does not have sons, then Yaakov, even though he is taken in something as an indentured servant, stands really to be the heir who's going to control the estate. And it's under his guidance that the estate suddenly grows and blossoms wonderfully. In which case, we have one of two choices. Either Yaakov leaves, in which case, if he leaves, he could end up leaving everything behind and everyone behind until he makes his claim to not Nashai, or else he might end up staying there, and staying there, he could end up being the heir. There are no other sons. Suddenly there are sons. Suddenly Laban has sons, and the sons show up, and now the sons have a complaint, which is, we're the sons, not this guy. We don't want him to inherit. And suddenly all of the feelings shift, and all of the politics shift. And suddenly the way that Laban is looking at Yaakov is not charitably and friendly and cooperatively like it was before, but suddenly it's negative. And just at that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Yaakov and says, time to go home. Yaakov speaks to the wives, and the wives say something very curious. What do they say? They say as follows, Vatan Rachel v'Leah, in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yodalad 31:14. Rachel and Leah respond, Vatvarna la ha'od lano chelek v'nachala b'veit avinu. Do we have any more portion left in our father's house? They're not asking about a spiritual portion, they're not asking an emotional portion, they're talking about inheritance. Because we missed something in this entire story. We know, it's true in the ancient world, it's true in halacha, it's true in contemporary society, that when a couple marries, the families provide for each of them in the following way. The husband, or the husband's family, depending on his age and his means, will provide what we call a ketubah, meaning a guarantee against divorce or death of the husband, that the issue will be taken care of. But on the other side, the girl brings in what we call a nedunya, a dowry, which really is not about giving something to the husband. It's really, as the Gemara in Ketubot says, about finding a way for a father to give an inheritance to his daughter. And that's why the Takanav, Ketubat Banim Dichrin, was established to make sure that a father will write a sizable dowry for his daughter, which will then serve as her inheritance of his estate, and therefore, if she dies, it will go to her children and not her husband's other children. That's Banim Dichrin. Where is the dowry here? Yaakov's worked for 14 years. Where is the dowry? And that's what the girls say. The girls say, do we have any more portion here? They interpret what Laban did as follows. They said, we are strangers, we are outsiders, we are not members of the household because he has sold us. And then, he has devoured our money. In other words, the money that really should be coming to us, it should be our inheritance, he has spent. And then they come up with the following observation. God has saved, has rescued money from father's estate and given it to us. How has that happened? Has happened with all of this fertility, with all of these lambs giving birth, specifically in the way that enriches Yaakov. They say, that's money that belongs to us and to our sons. That's our inheritance. And so therefore they say, whatever God said to you, let's do. If we have to leave, we'll leave, because we really don't have a portion here anymore. But we've gotten the inheritance. We've gotten the inheritance via HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand in the reproduction. So what we see has happened here is that we've gone from a relationship that really was a square, understood, contractual relationship in which everything was on the up and up, and nobody was really cheating each other. Again, we have to look at the entire switch with Leah and be careful about how quick we are to judge that. And which changes when the family dynamic changes. Does that happen at any other time in history? Of course it does. It goes back to Yitzchak and Ishmael, but it goes before Yitzchak and Ishmael. Think about this. When Avraham first got the news that he was going to be getting Eretz Yisrael, who was his heir? He says who his heir is. In the beginning of chapter 15, his heir is Eliezer. Damascus Eliezer. Suddenly Ishmael is born. Okay, Eliezer's out of the picture. Suddenly Ishmael is born. Who is the heir? Ishmael's the heir. That is true until what? Until Yitzchak is born. When Yitzchak is born, what's Sarah's claim? Sarah does not say, get rid of Ishmael is a bad influence. She does not say, get rid of Ishmael, he's promiscuous or idolatrous. She says, get rid of Ishmael because he's not going to inherit, Yitzchak will not inherit with him. In other words, will not share the inheritance. In other words, we are now taking the number one child because he's born of the proper wife, and he is becoming the sole heir, and this outside kid, who in the meantime filled the role of the son of the family, is now out. And that's what happens with Yishmael. It happens later on in Sefer Bereishit. It happens when Yosef, evidently, not necessarily upon his birth, but at some later point, becomes the favored son who Yaakov then favors and makes him the Bechor, and showers not only all of the favor upon him, but dresses him in what evidently is clothes of royalty. Perhaps we'll talk about that in Parshat Vayeshev, and ultimately grants him two portions in the land that he has. So, until Yosef was born, Reuven was the Bechor. But now, when Rachel, the beloved wife, the favored wife, has given birth to a son, so then the other sons are supplanted from their position. It happens later on in history. Take a look at Sefer Shoftim, Perak Yud Aleph, the story of Yiftach. We're all familiar with Yiftach. We all think about Yiftach as the one who made the foolish neder, and his daughter was killed as a result. But look at the beginning of the chapter. The beginning of chapter of Yud Aleph Shoftim. Yiftach is presented as a ben isha zonah. What's an isha zonah in that context? It's not how we normally interpret a harlot or a prostitute. It means she's like a concubine, a second-rate wife. He is very big in the household until what happens? Until the real wife has children, and then they throw him out. And they say, ben isha cheratata, you're some other woman's kid, get out of here. And they send him away, which of course sets up the story, because they later come back begging him to help them in their war. But this is a motif that shows up several times, and it evidently is a motif that is playing a role here in our parsha to explain the change in the relationship between Yaakov and Lavan that really happens as a result of changed circumstances that are out of Yaakov's control, and that is evidently the birth of sons in Lavan's house, who then stand to be the real heirs and do not want Yaakov to inherit. In the meantime, the inheritance that should have come to the daughters would never came to the daughters, and only because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu enriching Yaakov consistently through every deal that Yaakov would sign, that was the type of sheep that would be that would have the greatest fertility in that coming year. And even though Lavan kept rewriting the contract with him, it didn't help. Evidently, that's the way it plays out. That leads, of course, to a final confrontation on Har HaGilad, which is also about this entire event of Yaakov sneaking away, and what is the nature of the relationship, and how is this relationship severed. In any case, hopefully over the course of the last 35 minutes or so, we've had a chance to have a fresh look at the Parsha and read the characters and the relationships between them in a fresh light. This does not diminish by one iota the significance of the way that Lavan is presented in the Midrash, which may not necessarily be attuned to, or the concern of Chazal being how we should read Lavan in the text, but rather how we should understand the Lavan-like figures that continue to plague us throughout history. Everybody should have a great Shabbos.